So we start a whole new section, and I do want to try to understand as much as we can the continuity of the events. Last we noticed, Moshe went up. He goes up. The last thing we're told, he goes up for 40 days and 40 nights. Right? That's exactly how we ended Mishpatim. Vayavo Moshe betocha anan vayal el hahar. Moshe goes up for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, all of you have been raised on Rashi, so Rashi then will completely confuse you regarding what the proper sequence of events is over here. And for that matter, Rashi, the entire book of Shemot, I won't say the entire because it's only a slight overstatement, but I can assume that according to Rashi, from Perek Aleph to Perek Yud Tet, more or less... from Perek Aleph to Perek Yud, beginning of Yud Chet, you can say is in sequence. Once you get to the beginning of Yud Chet, then all bets are off. I mean, according to Rashi, Yud Chet, when Yitro shows up, Rashi there says, Vahim Macharat, it's day after Yom Kippur. Day after Yom Kippur, again, I'm not sure if you're paying attention. The Jews left Egypt on Pesach. Yom Kippur is a lot of months away. So they end up 3 months later, the Bar Sinai, because it tells us in the beginning of the 19th chapter, beginning of Perek Yud Chet, it says that in the third month, right, they end up by Har Sinai. So how is this the day after Yom Kippur in Perek Yud Chet? Which means Rashi's troubled by something. Correct. Which means if you look all the way by Vayakel, Perek Lamed Hey, right, that's the point Moshe comes down with the second Luchot, and now he gathers people together and he teaches them. There Rashi says that's Mimorchot Yom Kippurim. Which means according to Rashi, Perek Yud Chet and Perek Lamed Hey took place on the same day. Again, aside from everything else, all other trouble that we may have, I'm just pointing out that things are completely inverted. Apparently, part of what's bothering Rashi, because there's a lot more to talk about, but apparently part of what's bothering Rashi is the fact that if Moshe is sitting to judge the people, based on what is he judging the people? So based on judging the people on the Torah. So when did Moshe have a chance to teach them the Torah? Being that from the time Moshe goes up till he comes down the second time, Moshe sort of got occupied with other things. So therefore, when all the people are coming for judgment, Rashi finds it very convenient to say that that's already there by Perek Yud Chet. But as I said, that completely ruins any sense of continuity as we're reading it. Okay. The other part of it that Rashi does, which is not for today, it's really going back to last week and 2 weeks ago, and that is that Rashi in Perek Kaf Dalid, the preparations to going up, and Perek Yud Tet, the preparations, they're interdispersed. They're the same days. Perek Yud Tet and Kaf Dalid are the same days, according to Rashi. The one thing that he really gains by that, if he wants to, why is he doing this? The one thing that really is gained by that is that by Kaf Dalid, which, let's say I don't do what Rashi did. Let's say I just go straight from the beginning. So what happened? Perek Yud Chet Moshe is judging the people. I could say, again, if I try to channel my inner Ramban, those of you who don't know, the Ramban says things do follow the proper sequence unless you have no choice. So let's just try to work it out in that direction. Perek Yud Chet, Moshe is judging the people based on what? Based on whatever was received at Mara. Sham sam l'chokul mishpat v'shamni, right, shamni sal. By Mara they received mitzvot parshiyot Torah, which even Rashi says, the Gemara says. So over here, but it says in the Chumash, sham sam l'chokul mishpat. So they have some kind of chokul mishpat. So Moshe could then be judging the people then, before Har Sinai, based on what was already received by Mara. I then continue, Perek Yud Tet, prepare for Har Sinai. All that is prior to the Aseret HaDibrot. Okay? Afterwards, at the end of Perek Kaf, which is the Aseret HaDibrot, all the people move away and they tell Moshe, tell God to stop it. We just can't take it. Right? You speak to us and then we'll listen. We just can't take it. So then God explains to Moshe the Mishpatim, which means the Mishpatim then would be, and this may be a little strange the way I'm going to say it, the Mishpatim, which I think all of you noticed, right? I mentioned it last week also, all of you noticed how close the Mishpatim are to the Aseret HaDibrot. They fit into those 10 categories. So therefore, this would be what we would call the Torah Shebal Peh on the Aseret HaDibrot. Aseret HaDibrot are these 10 things. Here's the Torah Shebal Peh. And we start getting to the Arbot of Nezikin, we start getting the Shomrim and so on, and all that is the explanation that the people don't want to hear God say. They want to go to Moshe, that's the Mishpatim. Moshe still hasn't gone up yet. Right? Moshe hasn't gone up yet at all. The Chumash itself gives no timeline, which doesn't tell us, oh, it's this date, it's this date, it's that date. Rashi does. So Moshe gets the Aseret HaDibrot, he gets the explanation of the Aseret HaDibrot, Perek Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, Kaf Gimel, right? First two chapters of Mishpatim. Kaf Dalid, Moshe now prepares to go up. He goes up 40 days and 40 nights, which means I don't have to change anything. Now, what is the disadvantage of doing it this way? Well, what's the disadvantage of saying it like this? The disadvantage is that they say Naseh V'Nishma after they already learned all of Aseret HaDibrot and all of Parashat Mishpatim. They said Naseh V'Nishma after they already heard a very great deal of Torah. So what do I... Okay, if I follow the proper sequence, I've ruined one thing. What have I ruined? Naseh V'Nishma is no longer impressive at all. According to Rashi, and at this point I can't say Rashi's following Chazal, that if they haven't gotten anything yet... Because again, he keeps changing the whole time structure. They haven't received anything yet, so they say Naseh V'Nishma is very significant. Naseh V'Nishma is not there to Perek Kaf Dalet. They already heard the Mishpatim according to this. It says they already made a covenant on the Mishpatim. Yes? So I'm not going to go into all that detail. I'm just setting that up. Now, I then follow and I go, okay, what happens next? And ignore Rashi right now. So what happens next when Moshe goes up? God tells him, the next pasuk, by Deber Hashem Moshe Lemor, where does this happen? Up on the mountain. What does he say? Daber B'Neser V'chuli Truma. Which means the content of what Moshe learns when he's up on the mountain is Parsha Truma and Tetzaveh and so on. Which means the reality is there's no reason whatsoever for me to deviate from the sequence of events as told in the Chumash and start playing games with Ein Mukdam and Mukhar the Torah. On the other hand, all of you know the Rashi. You may not know where it is, so I'll tell you. All of you know the Rashi, which is in Perek Lamed Aleph Pasuk Yudchet, on the Pasuk, Vayitain el Moshe kichalatolo deberito bar Sinai shnei luchot ha'idud, luchot even ketuvim be'etz balokim, that God gives him the Aseret HaDibrot, Lamed Aleph Yudchet. Here it says, Rashi says on that, Ein muktam u'muchor b'torah. Maseh ha'egel kodim tzivoy melechet ha'mishkan yamim rabim haya. That Rashi here says, no, the Chet Egel happens next. Which means Moshe goes up. Okay, we have 40 days. Also, according to Rashi, we have no idea what happens in those 40 days. What would Rashi really claim happened those 40 days? More likely than not, he'd say Parshat Mishpatim is what happens those 40 days. Prakim Kuf Aleph, Kuf Bet, and Kuf Gimel. That's what God says when Moshe's up on the mountain. He teaches in Parshat Mishpatim. So I'm just pointing out. So that's what happens. That's what Moshe's learning. Moshe comes down, the Chet Egel. So when do they get the Tzivoy? So Rashi claims it's after they come down the second time. V'yom Kippurim nitratzeh HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael, l'macharat itchilu b'nidvat ha-mishkan v'ukam b'chad b'nisan. Now, one point that Rashi's saying is accurate, now that I'm giving points over here, giving gold stars, it is true they don't start to build the Mishkan till after Moshe comes down the second time, v'yimacharat. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the conversation between God and Moshe is not until this point. You understand what I'm saying? Moshe does not relay the message regarding the Mishkan until after Yom Kippur on that first year. After they're forgiven, then they start building the Mishkan. But now the question is a different question. The question is, at which point does God say this to him? Now, you all understand what I just now did, or when I threw all those chapter names, you have no idea what I'm talking about. Yes? So why don't you stop me then? Kaf Aleph, Kaf Bet, and Kaf Gimel are the first three chapters in Mishpatim, right? Yudchet, Yutet, and Kaf are the three chapters in Yitra. Okay, so just think it through. Everything I said made sense. Yes. I don't have to say anything. I'm just pointing out that there's two possibilities over here which are very, very different. One possibility is I can claim that everything till this point has been its proper sequence, or I can claim that everything is completely inverted. Rashi doesn't seem to be bothered at all. Rashi's not troubled at all. He's ready to go like this. Again, Perek Yudchet happens at the same time as Perek Lamed Hei. Again, just Consider that for a second. Rashi is willing to say that Perek Yud-Tet, which is the one before in Yitro, before Moshe goes up, and Perek Kavdalid, which is at the end of Mishpatim, are the same days, describing the same events. As I said, what has Rashi gained from all this? Naaseh v'Nishma just became more meaningful, at least in terms of the first issue. In terms of the second issue, what's that? The second issue is going back to our parsha, to Truma. When did this conversation take place? According to Rashi, the instructions of Truma are not until after the Cheta Egel. Now, how would you take this now one step further? And therefore, had there not been, okay, this is what you can start thinking, had there not been a Cheta Egel, I can then start to argue, there would not have been a Mishkan, right? And the whole thing there is really because we messed up, so we get a Mishkan, okay? Now, I don't believe that's what Rashi really said, okay? And I want to say this in a very clear way, and then we're going to try to, you know, go a little bit deeper. I think that we're putting words in Rashi's mouth. It's not that no one ever said such a thing. I just don't think that Rashi really says that. See, let's go back to the Ramban for a second. The Ramban believes that there really is what we can call chronological integrity in the Chumash, at least till this point. He would feel no reason to say that Yud-Chet happened after Lano. Yud-Chet happened right there, and Yud-Tet happened right there. And Kaf Aleph, Kapet, and Kaf Gimel happened right there, and Kaf Dalet happened right there, and for that matter, Kaf Hein, and so on, all happened at those moments. And therefore, the Ramban would say, the instructions to build the Mishkan is what God said to Moshe when he goes up for those 40 days. And what would be the reason to say this? Someone started to ask me, what's the reason to say this? Because that's exactly what the Chumash says. Make believe that there are no chapters. I know that you're all very religious followers of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And then I know that you want to give him all of the possible cover that you can. Make believe there are no chapters right now. Okay, can you do that? Make believe right now for the moment that you're going to follow, that you don't have to follow the system where we read the Chumash every year, right? There's also a triennial system, but let's ignore all that. Ignore the parshiot, ignore the chapters. The last pasuk says, Moshe goes up for 40 days and 40 nights. What does the next pasuk say? And God said to Moshe, saying, Daber al bnei Yisrael chuli truma. Why in the world would any of you say to me that that's not the next pasuk, is not the next event that happened? Why would you feel a need to say, no, hold it a second. This happened. No, that's the next thing which is said. So therefore, Moshe goes up 40 days and 40 nights. What does God say? God says, build a Mishkan. And therefore, what do we end up with that approach? The Mishkan is not a response to the Cheta Egel. The Mishkan is something which God instructs. Now, I wrote an essay this week, which I'll only quote myself a little bit, but one of the things that I try to draw a parallel between was between the Sulam of Yaakov and between the Moshe going up. Because when you have the sulam, you suddenly get a perspective from above, right? And not just a perspective from down below. But what happens when Yaakov gets that perspective? What happens when he wakes up? What's his conclusion? His conclusion is, I'm going to build a Beit Hashem. What does he say? He makes a neder. I'm going to build a house for God. Oh, is that after the Cheta Egel also? Okay, I'm a little cynical. Is Yaakov's vow to make a Beit Hashem, is that a response to the Cheta Egel? You can say no now if you want to. You can't even go that far. Probably not. By the way, there are various references to building a Beit Hashem also in the Oz Yashir. Go and look at it carefully. There are references there as well. The Nevei Kodshecha. There are references there as well to building a house for God. There are references to Korbanot in Perek Kaf. Remember, you're going to build a Mizbeach. How do you build a Mizbeach? Right after the Seret HaDibrot. There are references to also building a Mizbeach, and maybe even a Beit Hashem, in Parshat Mishpatim. So that to say that the whole thing is just a mistake, I think is hard to say. I'm going to say it like this. I'm going to say it very, very different, but listen to this. If I'm not mistaken, Rashi would never argue that there was supposed to be a Beit HaMikdash. Rashi believes it's supposed to be Beit HaMikdash. Rashi may, however, believe there would have been no need for a Mishkan.
No,
I'll say it again. You can start getting carried away once you see this Rashi. And there have been people, not Rashi. I said people start getting carried away with it. According to Rashi, there always would have been a Beit HaMikdash. What would there not have been possibly? A Mishkan. Why? Why? They're going straight into Eretz Yisrael. You're going straight into Eretz Yisrael. You come down from the mountain. Yeah, which means how was this supposed to happen? How was this story supposed to play out? Moshe was to come down, right? They're supposed to celebrate, and they're supposed to march into the land of Israel. Moshe leading the way. Moshe is going to be appointed Melech HaMashiach, the army direction, let's say this. Build the Beit HaMikdash, and everything, that's it. We move straight to the end of history. We sort of messed up along the way. I don't know if you ever noticed this. We sort of messed up along the way, and the messing up will end up being that we're going to be in the desert for 40 years. Being in the desert in the 40 years, now suddenly, what do I need? Now I need a Mishkan. Which means, my point over here is, had they gone straight to Eretz Yisrael, then everything which is described over here, they could have built this. They could have built this and placed it down in Yerushalayim. They didn't have to build a Mishkan. That's what I'm saying. Even according to Rashi, that everything is not in the proper order, I could say that the instructions for building the Mishkan are after the Chayta Egel, according to Rashi, because according to Rashi, they never needed a temporary tabernacle, whatever that is. They never would have needed a temporary one, because they could have gone straight to Eretz Yisrael and built the permanent one. So that's what I'm suggesting according to Rashi. Again, I'm trying to narrow, to some extent, the divide between Rashi and the Ramban. What happens according to the Ramban? Moshe goes up, and he gets the most important message. What's the most important message? Build the Mishkan. It's holiness. It's Kedusha. We need a Beit Hashem, a Beit HaBechira. So I'm just pointing out that it could be that Rashi is not as far from the Ramban as you would think. Yes, there's going to be major differences on how to explain most of Sefer Shemot, but it doesn't mean that it really comes down to it, that according to Rashi, I could put words in his mouth and say, had there not been a Chayta Egel, there never would have been a Beit HaMikdash. Rashi didn't say that. So I'm just saying that's going a little... Excuse me? Rashi does believe the order of the Mishkan was not given until after there was a Chayta Egel. Okay, he says that? Yeah, he does say that. He makes it sound like when they start to build it is when they got the orders as well. I'm saying one does not have to say that. Not if Moshe leads the way. It took a couple years the way that we did it. If Moshe leads the way, it doesn't take that kind of time. By the way, Chazal eventually say that the fact that Moshe didn't go into Eretz Yisrael, the fact that Moshe didn't build the Beit HaMikdash, this is a Medrash in Eicha, this is an unbelievable chesed on God's part. And I'll say it again. Had Moshe gone in, the Beit HaMikdash never would have been destroyed. So what happens if Am Yisrael sins? Am Yisrael gets destroyed. So that's what it says, that God says, I take out my wrath on Eitz Ve'Evan. I take out my wrath on wood and on stones. And by the way, Eitz Ve'Evan also, the Gra points out, is a representation of Christianity, which has to do with the wood, the cross, and Evan has to do with the stone, has to do with Islam. So if God wants to take his wrath out on Eitz Ve'Evan, so Baruch Hashem. But that's what the Midrash says, is that had Moshe led them in, Beit HaMikdash would have lasted forever. Only question is, what about Am Yisrael? So they said, you have to understand, even when you see something which looks absolutely horrific, there still may be chesed involved in that as well. And I think that that's a very powerful and very important message. Now, let's go back then to the beginning of Truma. So those of you who are completely lost, that's Perakaf Hei. Right, but that didn't happen yet. Rashi, it's an excellent question. Rashi actually says the reason they're there for 40 years is because of the Chayta Egel, not because of the Chayta Meraglim. Right? Why? Because it's Yom Hashanah, Yom Hashanah. So he says that, no, they had to be there for 40 years because he says that they got a sentence for 40 years already then, but they got a suspended sentence. Once they sinned again, then the suspended sentence was removed and they get it back. But Rashi does say it's for the Chayta Egel, not for the Chayta Meraglim. As I said, Rashi's consistent, right? Rashi does say that. Yeah. Again? Yeah, Kid Varecha, but not complete. It's not complete. By the Chayta Egel, the Pshat and Chumash there, Pshat and Chumash is it was not that the sin was forgiven, but they got a mortgage in terms of payments. They got to pay it off under a lot of payments instead of having to pay it once. Okay. I know you don't want to talk about the Mishkan at all. You want to go to the Chayta Egel, it's more interesting. You want to go to the Meraglim, it's more interesting. But you're stuck here. We have to a little bit about Truma. So, the Parsha begins collecting various materials. I'm not going to go into all the materials. Pasuk Chet. Vasuli Mikdash Veshachanti Bitucham. Build for me a sanctuary. Do you like that translation of Mikdash? Vasuli Mikdash, build for me a sanctuary. So you have the word Kodesh, sanctified inside the middle. Vasuli Mikdash Veshachanti Bitucham. And the Tocham is what's interesting, and it's not an accident. It says it again later on. What does Bitocham mean? And I will dwell within the people. By the way, a number of times in the Parsha, it does say how to build it. You'll build it the way that I'm showing you on the mountain. Shemore al-Ahar. So when did the instructions come? When he's on the mountain. Okay, I'm just saying that as another thing to take into consideration. Correct. Vinatata pasuk tet zayin, vinatata el ha'aron et ha'edut asher etein elecha, and you're going to put inside the aron. I skipped the instructions building the aron into the aron. You're going to put the testimony which I'm going to give you. Now it talks about the covering that you're going to put in. Vasita kaporet zahav tahar matayim v'chetzi erkov v'amav v'chetzi rachva. Vasita shneim kruvim zahav miksheta aseotam mishnek tzota kaporet. And you'll put these two kruvim on top of the kaporet, which is on top of the aron. Vasei kruv achad mikotzeh mizeh v'kruv achad mikotzeh mizeh min kaporet asuot kruvim al shnek tzotav. V'yu kruvim porsei knafav l'mala, they'll have their wings stretched out. So yichim mikanfeim al kaporet pneim ish al achiv et kaporet yu pnei kruvim. Which you can accuse of repetition. And I will speak to you there. I'll communicate to you from on top of the kaporet, between the two kruvim. Everything I have to say, I'm going to communicate now. I'm going back to the Ramban. The Ramban understands, and he says this in at least three different places. The Ramban understands the purpose of the Mishkan is to take the communication between God and Am Yisrael, the one-time communication that took place on Har Sinai, and to put it into a permanent display where it can be repeated. Which means, as far as the Ramban is concerned, there is going to be a direct connection between Har Sinai and the Mishkan. By the way, he says this, one of the times he says it, is at the very end of Sefer Shemot, where you have the same psukim as we just now read. What did we read them? At the very end of Mishpatim, where it says that 40 days and 40, but right before that it says, Moshe waits 6 days, and then he's able to go up through the clouds. Same pasuk said, the glory of God comes down into the Mishkan, and Moshe has to wait before he can enter into it. The exact same description is given. The Ramban is saying that that's the purpose over here. Let me break it down on a different level. I'm going to say it simpler now, and then we'll go back to the larger way to say it, or the deeper way to say it. When Moshe comes down with the Luchot, he has a problem. Very simple, functional, practical, pragmatic problem. What is it? Where do you put these Luchot down? I once got on a plane from Israel to California carrying a Sefer Torah. I brought a Sefer Torah to somebody for a bar mitzvah. I had the Sefer Torah in my house the night before. Do you know, it's not a very settling thought having a Sefer Torah. Where do you put it down? I'm asking you practically, where do you put it down? Thank God I flew with El Al, and the stewardesses were very, they all, you know, really with incredible kavod to the Sefer Torah, you know, where can we put it, whatever, and they made sure. You think it's a simple thing? Moshe comes down with a lucha. What is he going to do with him? Where does he put him down? No, I'm being, as I said, totally practical. What do you do with it? So that's what the Chumash says here. By the way, now you realize why the sequence now is so important. Moshe goes up and God says, I'm going to give you these luchot. Build a mishkan. Build an aron. Put them in. Now you have a place to put it. Okay. You need a place to put it. So if I were then to say to you, what is the most basic function of the Mishkan? I know this sounds funny. What's the most basic function of the Mishkan? What's the answer? A place to put the Luchot. That's what it says in the Chumash here. Yes, you heard it say it? No. Or no? Right? Simply said, a place you can put it. But then it continues. And it says, and from this place, I'm going to communicate. Now, the last major communication between God and the Jewish people is on the mountain. The voice of God flows. So now the voice of God is going to flow. And again, by the way, what did the voice of God say? It said the Seret Dibrot. Now, in the same place that the Seret Dibrot are going to sit, the voice of God is going to continue. So you have a Seret Dibrot, the continuing conversation. By the way, the people moved away from that. You then have the Seret Dibrot and the continuing conversation coming from the place that the Seret Dibrot are going to be. That's now, again, more or less the relationship. Question, comment, answer?
No, I was going to say, regarding the Luchot.
Excuse me?
Regarding the Luchot.
Yeah.
Is there, you're saying it's like there's some part we couldn't put them down? They're not, like, I understand they're from God. Does that make them important? But in terms of like the physical, like, anything, it's not, they're not so.
Not so holy.
Yeah, I mean, like, they're.
The
Meshech.
The Meshech Chachma. He doesn't say it in Shemot, so nobody knows that he says it. The Meshech Chachma doesn't say this till Devarim, if I'm not mistaken. He says, when Moshe sees the Chet Egel, he breaks the Lucha. Why? He says, if they're going to worship something which is made, man-made, they're certainly going to end up worshiping the Luchot as well. That's why he breaks them. And the new Luchot, he writes, they're not Etzbe Elokim. He says, these people have this desire to worship Avodah Zarah. They're definitely going to turn into Avodah Zarah. The Kutzker Rebbe went in that direction as well. He says, the Jews can turn anything to Avodah Zarah, even Torah. Okay? Yes. Anyway, ask any brisker. So, no, I'm saying it's, there's Kedusha. There's Kedusha to it. Yeah. The Kutzker?
Yeah.
Look in Emes Vemuna Mikutzk. Is that going to help you? But there's another thing. It's all there. Or there's another book which says Emes Mikatz Titzmach. Okay. Anyway, there are a couple of books like this have collections of the Kutzker's sayings. Okay. You know why on Purim do we read a couple of psukim with the tune from Eicha? So the Litvak also can have something to celebrate. So why not read the whole thing through the tune of Eicha? Because we don't want them to have so much happiness. Okay. So.
What's the function of the Kutzker?
No.
What's the function of the person that's... It's not necessarily like... What would Rashi say is the function of the Luchos?
What would Rashi say?
Like, is there also a difference in the function of the Luchos?
I'm not sure if I'd go that far. Now, let's talk a little bit about symbolism. I understand. Let's talk.
A practical purpose?
Okay. I agree with you. They're very impractical. I guess that's why he broke them.
You're not supposed to read that.
Okay. So, let's talk a little bit about symbolism. The way to really understand everything in Truma Tetzav and so on about the Mishkan is to understand the symbolism involved. Every single one of these, every single item, every single element has symbolism. Of course, I'm not going to back that up and explain it all, but I'm going to try to do one thing, and that's all. Now, we are very biased, and we have to recognize our bias. When we look at people in antiquity, we think that they were literal in the way that they looked at things in their lives. In our lives, we forgive ourselves, and we right away say, no, this is symbolic, or it's branding. Here, look at your computer there. What's the symbol on your computer? Not just an apple. An apple with a bite from it. So what's the symbol of the apple with a bite from it? An apple in Christological understanding, symbolism, would be the tree of knowledge of good and evil. What's the bite from it? That you took a bite from this tree of knowledge of good and evil. So therefore, you have gone, right, and brazenly been involved in taking wisdom, even though that there's good and evil involved in that kind of machine, right? Even though there's good and evil over there, but now you've boldly gone. And but all of you would say, no, it's just branding. What's the branding? The branding means you overpaid for a computer. I mean, that's what the branding is. But
is that shot there with their symbol?
I don't know if this is pshat. I get to say pshat. What do I care what they think? I get to say pshat what I think that it means. That's what I think that it means. But my point is that none of you take this seriously in to say, oh, why are they called apple? Because they grow near an apple? No, it has nothing to do with it. Right away, you don't think in those terms at all. But when we look at people from a couple of thousand years, oh, they were really primitive because they believed in these guys. No. They also thought symbolically the way we think symbolically. And I'll say it again. We live with a bias. We judge people from the past from being literal, and we forgive ourselves. Come on. Some of you are going to go to college next year, and you're going to run around and go to Oregon. You're going to run around after ducks, right, and think that ducks are something which are holy. They worship this in the University of Oregon. Their football team name is the Ducks. Who cares? So an anthropologist from 1,000 years ago, in Oregon, they used to worship the duck. And you would see grown men running around after the duck and bowing down to the duck and so on. Or I can keep on going now to every single college where they have similar things going on. Forget about, can you imagine what anthropologists can do with colleges in America today? Again, from the future, going back and looking, saying, I wouldn't even get to the mating rights between. we won't go there. Apparently that they needed to intoxicate the other greatly before they would have their mating rights and so on and so forth. But it's, what's the matter? You okay? Tov, let's continue. I'm not going to say I'm going to behave. I'll make an effort. A little. So, we have the Kruvim. I want to understand the Kruvim. That's all for today. I want to try to understand the Kruvim. The first thing, which is annoying, with a G, annoying, troubling issue, and that is, what is the difference between the Kruvim and between the Egel? They're both made out of gold. And you can start, by the way, you can tell me all that you want. When it comes down, this is a very disappointing answer, because the answer is Simon Says. Right? This God said to do, and this God didn't say to do. Which means it's a procedural issue and not one of substance. Because you know if the other way around, if God would have said, and take two little calves and put them on top of this, and the people then made a golden kruv, then you would have, again, you would have, no, it's not substance, right? You all hear what I'm saying? It doesn't seem to be an issue of substance. By the way, and I'm not now dealing with what the possible symbolism was involved in a calf. There may be a lot more to that than you're possibly considering right now, but that's not our problem for today. Right now, our problem is the Kruvim. So what were the Kruvim like? Tell me about the Kruvim. What do you know about our Kruvim? They look like babies, and therefore the right kit rubia, like a baby. Good. What else do you know? Okay. What else do you know? Maybe. Yes. Okay. Good. So this is a Gemara in Baba Batra. It says that the Kruvim were spiritual barometers, because it uses two different verses. One verse indicates they face at one another. One verse indicates that they were away from one another. If I can quickly find the Gemara, I will read it to you. Where is it? It wasn't Baba Batra. Yeah, it's still there. Tzaditet. It says, Ketzad hin omdim, how do they stand? Rav Yochanan of Lazar. One of them quotes the pasuk in this week's parsha, says they were facing one another. And one says that they faced towards the wall of the Mishkan, or Beit HaMikdash. It says in Divrei Yamim, they faced the wall. Look, so the Gemara says, no, lo kasha. Kan bizman she Yisrael osim ritzonu shamakom, kan bizman she ein Yisrael osim ritzonu shamakom. The Gemara ends up saying that the Kruvim were spiritual barometers that would able to take the temperature, as it were, of Am Yisrael in terms of their fidelity to God. When Am Yisrael were close to God, they would face one another. When they were rebelling from God, they would turn from one another. That's what the Gemara over here says. Before I continue, do you know any other information about them? Anything else about them?
Gold.
Gold? Made of one piece of gold. The Zohar adds one more piece of information, which, as far as I know, is not said clearly in other places, but is generally accepted, even if a picture of the Kruvim here and accepts it, and that is that one was male and one was female. Okay? So we have two baby-like looking creatures made of one piece of gold, maybe or not facing one another. So the Gemara in Yoma then tells us as follows. The Gemara is interpreting a verse in Eicha. Eicha, of course, is a verse which describes the Chorban. So in the beginning, in the first chapter of Eicha, it says, Kol machamadeha hiziluha kira'u ervata. All of their things that they cherished, kol machamadeha, all the things that were chamud, that were cherished by them, hiziluha. They cheapened it. Kira'u ervata, for they saw her nakedness. The Gemara in Daf Nun Dalet in Yoma says, Amareish Lakish b'shar shenichnusu nachrim leheichal, when the heathens went and they entered into the Beit HaMikdash. Now, think a second. How will the Kruvim look? We're told, when the Jews do the will of God, they look at one another. When the Jews are not doing the will of God, they don't look at one another. So what would we now assume? We would now assume that during the time of the Churban, not only the Jews not doing the will of God, these things should have, you know, pulled apart and, like, you know, run to different corners there. But it says the opposite. It says they walked in, Re'u Kruvim hamu'urim zebezeh. They found the two Kruvim in an embrace. And they look at this, and they're shocked, and I'm going to be very clear what it is that it says. They think they're seeing child pornography. That's what they think that they see. The Gemara says, Hotziam l'shuk, and they carried it out to the marketplace. V'amr, and they said, Yisrael halalu, the Jews. Shebirchatam brachal klatan kala. Normally, they have a refined sense of morality. What they bless is really blessed. When they curse is really cursed. Yasku b'dvarim halalu. The Jews are involved in this kind of pornography. Miyad hiziluham. And therefore they cheapened it. And it quotes the Pasuk in Eicha, Kol machmadeh hizilu ki ra'u ervata. It's a fascinating Gemara that's telling us that the nakedness that they saw was the Kruvim. They see the Kruvim. But by the way, we have a huge question here. The question is, why are the Kruvim holding on to one another? The answer, by the way, I think is obvious. If it's not obvious, then I'll say it anyway. I don't have to say it if it's not obvious. I think what it's saying is, every time Yirmiyahu would come in, or any other Navi prior, there's going to be a Churban. What did the average person think? What are you talking about? This is a house of God. Nobody can destroy the house of God. It's impossible. So you realize then that you can do whatever you want, because the Beit HaMikdash will always be there, because there's no power on this earth that can destroy it. So therefore, the Beit HaMikdash became a spiritual liability, instead of something which brought people closer to God. At that point, God, I won't say God had no choice, because God decided that the best thing to do is to destroy it. But the whole time, the people didn't believe it. At which point did they start to believe it? When they smashed through the walls and they started to destroy it. What did all the people start doing at that point? They started to daven. How strongly were they praying? With unbelievable conviction. How do I know they daven with unbelievable conviction? Because the Kruvim were holding on to one another. Which means what the Gemara and Baba Batra told us, when they do the will of God, they're looking at one another. They weren't only looking at one another, they were embracing one another. Which means the tefillot at that moment was so intense and was so real. But of course, what was the problem? It was too late. By the way, according to Rav Tzadok, that moment of intimacy between the two Kruvim, between the male and the female Kruv, that moment of intimacy, that's what created the Neshama of Mashiach. And when we learn from the Yerushalmi, it says that at the moment of the Churban, is when the Shiach is born on Tisha B'Av. So it says that's where it comes from. That intimacy between Am Yisrael and the Jewish people. That visual, that embrace between the Kruvim is a symbol of the Jewish people and the Kaddish Baruch Hu absolutely together at that point, but it was too late. So there's another explanation that says that before a man leaves his wife, goes off on a trip, so then he should be intimate with her. So before Am Yisrael is going to go and separate from the Beit HaMikdash and go off into Galut, so then there's this obligation of intimacy, and that's what creates the neshama, as it were, of Mashiach. But as I said, these things all revolved around the same point. Now, I want to go a little bit further to try to understand, because I haven't explained it yet. I mean, quite the opposite. What we do now understand is the Kruvim were something which could easily be misunderstood, something which the heathens come in and look at, and they totally misinterpret. And maybe that's part of the reason why we were unable to see it on a normal basis. Again, let's keep in mind, the only one who would see the Kruvim on a normal basis was the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, after preparing, going to the Kodesh Kodashim, he would then see this. And by the way, if he would see the two Kruvim looking at one another, so I think he had a certain sense in his heart, okay, these tefillot are being accepted. If he sees the Kruvim not looking at one another, he has to really start doing the Avodah. He has to really start doing something in order for Am Yisrael to be salvaged at that point. But we haven't yet explained what exactly is this image of the Kruvim. I want to suggest something. I've never seen anybody say this, but I think that's true anyway. I'm going to say it. I'm going to try to prove it. I'm going to try to explain it. And I'm going to try to show you, you know, what it's all about. When I think of the following pieces of information, okay, let's start with a baby. Cherub, in English as well. That's why every year we read this parsha right near Valentine's Day. It's Mamish Ben HaShemayim, okay? Mm-hmm. So you have a cherub. A cherub is a baby. Something, keruv, looks like a baby. Keruvia looks like a baby. What's special about a baby? What's special about a baby is purity or innocence. There's probably nothing as tragic as looking at a little kid in the eye and a kid who lost their innocence. One of my sons works with children who have a great deal of emotional difficulties at kindergarten. He works with them. And, you know, when a four-year-old tells you, with pride, I have a police record, you say, something's gone terribly wrong. He deals with kids, four-year-old, who are dealing. I'm saying it's unbelievable. Like, the things you couldn't imagine. He can tell you stories. Kids should have innocence. That's the first thing. Total purity, innocence. Second thing is made out of gold. Gold is also pure. Also purity there. But what's significant to me is that, okay, they're naked. And that they're of one piece. I put all this together and it's obvious what I'm going to say. And that is that the Kruvim represent Adam and Eve before the sin. Adam and Eve, the first day of creation. Unbelievable innocence. By the way, they're connected, made out of one. They get separated, right? They were connected by the rib. They get separated. This is why men like ribs so much. It's some kind of tikkun, right? But let's understand what happened. And they're naked. When what? How do I know Adam and Eve are naked? That's part of the description. Let me go in one second. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, they sin. They mess up. Which, by the way, is that the natural thing or is that the unnatural thing? Is to sin natural or unnatural? What's the answer? Natural. We all sin. That's also part of the human condition. We sin. In Christianity, there's a whole discussion, what is original sin? For us, what is original sin? So again, let's be very careful now. They eat from the tree. They realize they're naked. Now they have to start covering themselves up. The voice of God comes, and what does God say? Also very important. What does God say? He says, Ayeka. Notice the same letters of Ayeka, Aleph, Yud, Kaf, same letters as Echa. It's the same sound that comes out by the Churban that comes out of Ayeka. Where are you? Adam and Eve are hiding. God is calling out, which means even though we sin, God's presence is still there. Even though we sinned, God is still calling for us, reaching out for us, but we're hiding. And by the way, the reality is there's nothing more pathetic than that, than man who thinks he can hide from God. We're still in the Garden of Eden. That's incredibly significant. Because what could have happened is the same way that Adam and Eve sense that they're naked, they could have sensed, I can't be in this place. But they're hiding there. God says, Ayeka, right? God says to Adam what happened. And here is really where the terrible sin is. This is the sin. This is why he's kicked out. Not for eating. What does he say? He says, it's the woman you gave me. He says, it's the woman. He goes, you gave me a bimbo. You didn't give me a smart woman. What's so funny? It's my English translation of what it says. It's what it says in the Chumash. And by the way, this is the first time that we're going to have this excuse, which will come again and again and again. You're all going to use it also. One day they're going to ask what happened. So you blame you blame your parents, you blame your wife, you blame your rabbis. If I had better rabbis, I'd be okay. If I had a better wife, I'd be okay. If I had better parents, I'd be okay. You're going to blame everyone in the world other than the one person. Well, by the way, did he have another alternative? Can Adam have said something else at that point? What could have you said? I messed up. You gave me Yetzirah. I messed up. What do you want? I messed up. I'm sorry. I'll try really hard not to do it again. I will do all I can not to do it again. Sorry. How do I know Adam wasn't even Jewish? If he was Jewish, he never would have done this. He would have done it because Jews... What would he have done if he was Jewish? What does it say afterwards? God kicks him out and says, lest he goes and eats from the tree of life, Meitzachayim, which means the Eitzachayim still would have worked. What should Adam have done? He should have gone first and eat from the Eitzachayim. So now he's going to live forever. And then eat from the Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra. Right? And then God says, okay, you got a problem now. What are you going to do now? But Adam doesn't do this. I mean, again, that's the Yetzirah is self-destructive. By the way, that's the real conclusion. The Yetzirah is self-destructive. Because if you really thought it through, you go for the Eitzah Chaim first, then you go to the Eitzah Das. No. Totally self-destructive, and that's what the Yetzirah does. Adam goes to the tree, he eats from it, fine, we all mess up. The difference in life between being successful or not is not whether you mess up or not. All of us mess up. The question is, what do you do afterwards? Okay, a long time ago in America, this is history now, there was once a president named Richard Nixon. All of you know that Richard Nixon got impeached, and all you know they got impeached because of Watergate. Do you all know that he was not involved in Watergate? He was not involved in the break-in. He had nothing to do with the break-in. What he did have to do with the cover-up afterwards. It's how he dealt with it afterwards, not the crime itself. The crime itself he had nothing to do with, at least supposedly. No, seriously, he had nothing to do with it, but it's the cover-up, which means what kind of person you're going to be, what kind of person we're going to be, what kind of people we're going to be, comes down to how do you handle yourself after you made the mistake. This is true in every single relationship, every professional job that you have. Every single human being will make mistakes. Now, what do? Do you cover it up? Do you deny it? Do you point the finger at somebody else? Do you say it's because of her? And she does the same thing. She points the finger at somebody else. Which means they're still in the Garden of Eden. They're still in Gan Eden. If they would have said at that point to Kadosh Baruch Hu, I'm sorry, we're sorry, we messed up. You gave us the Yetzirah and we listened to it. We're sorry. I don't believe they would have been kicked out. Again, you can't argue with me on this. You can say you do believe. I don't believe. I don't believe they would have been kicked out. Which means I'm claiming, according to Judaism, original sin is not eating from the tree. The original sin is, first of all, Adam HaRishon. Rashi says he was kafui tov. He wasn't able to say thank you to God for this woman. By the way, this was his real soulmate. God gave him his soulmate. So he doesn't say thank you for the soulmate. He says, why do you give me such a bimbo? Because of her, look what happened to me. Messed up my life because of her. No, that's your soulmate, by the way. That woman who messed up your life, that is your soulmate. So that's the problem. Everybody, you know, is looking for the shidduch, looking for the perfect shidduch. They don't realize that you're very imperfect. So therefore, the perfect shidduch for an imperfect person is a very imperfect shidduch. Wow, unbelievable. If you understood what I just now said, I apologize. Okay. No, because again, we want that perfect person who's going to then straighten us up and do everything and help them. You're a loser. You're going to marry a loser. What's your problem? Okay, anyway, let's... Let me get back now. What happens right after God kicks them out? He places Kruvim on the path to the Eitz HaChaim, which means there we have the Kruvim. That's the Kruvim. The Kruvim are guarding the path to the Eitz HaChaim. What's the Eitz HaChaim? What's the Eitz Chaim? Eitz Chaim Yilamachzikim Ba is Torah. Which means a long, 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 long time ago, man sinned by being unwilling to fix his sin. Should I say that again? Man sinned by being unwilling to fix his sin. That's the sin that we had in the Garden of Eden. The sin was being unwilling to recognize it, owning up to it, taking responsibility for it, and trying to fix it. That was the sin. So if that's the case, the Kruvim then guard the path. But it's interesting, as Adam and Eve devolve from being these perfect spiritual beings, total innocence, they lose their innocence, and what takes their place now right in front? the crew of them now get introduced. So now all these years later, we go, we stand by Sinai, the Torah is received. God gives us the Torah, gives us the Luchot, and he says, now build a place which is holy once again. The last place that we had that was really holy was Gan Eden. Build a place which is holy once again. This place which is holy is going to serve as a place to fix your sins when you sin. That's what the Mishkan's going to be for. That's what the Beit HaMikdash is for. You're going to bring the Korbanot there. You're going to try to fix the sins, but this only works if you have the ability of saying, I'm sorry. It only works if you have the ability to say, I want to get close to God after I've messed up. Which means the whole idea of the Mishkan, what's it there for? It's to bring us close to God after we mess up. But this only works if we have this idea, this concept, that it's possible to fix it if we realize what we've messed up, if we realize it's our fault, if we're not pointing our fingers in every single direction. And then, inside, the Kadosh HaKadoshim is going to be a symbol of man at his apex. Unfortunately, the apex was the very first day. Man in complete purity. The Kohen Gadol, Aaron, will walk inside and take a look at these Kruvim. See something which is so pure. What's the problem with seeing something which is so pure and so holy? That we move so far away from it, then we see it, we cheapen it. We've lost the ability of looking at holiness and really appreciating it. We become cynical and we just can't embrace holiness. We've become like those heathens. We look at it and say, oh, look at that, it's child pornography. Like, what is this? This is what the Jews do? No. It's Adam and Eve before the sin, but we're not even at the level to look at it. The level that we're on is to look at the Kohen Gadol after he looked at it. And as I said, the Kohen Gadol needs to prepare and he takes all the sins in. That's the Mare Kohen. The Kohen Gadol walks out and you see the Kohen Gadol when he walks out of the Kadosh Kadoshim, he has this glow. What's the glow from? He just saw the Kruvim. He just saw what man can be like. And when we look at the Kohen Gadol, we try in ourselves to revisit who we were, to revisit who we can be, by looking in his eyes that looked at the Kruvim, and we realize how far we are, but there's still a possibility of fixing it. Without realizing that there's a possibility to fix it, the whole thing is absurd. Now there's a whole new opportunity. Now we have the Eitz Chaim. Now we stood by Har Sinai. Now we accepted the Torah. Once we accept the Torah, the world is completely different. Adam and Eve sinned before they accepted the Torah. They went to the Eitz Hadat Tov V'Ra before they went to the Eitz Chaim. Kruvim protect the path to the Eitz Chaim. Kruvim protect the Torah, the Eitz Chaim, which is sitting. That's where they're sitting. It's on in the Mishkan, on the Ark, on top of the Luchot. That's the Eitz Chaim. It's right there, protecting the Torah. The Kruvim, therefore, in the Mishkan are the same concept of the Kruvim back there in Gan Eden, and I just added one step to it, and now they've taken the place of Adam and Eve. So therefore, what the Kruvim try to do is the most important thing that can ever do, and that is to try to rehabilitate man. I quoted from the Kutzker, I'll quote from the Kutzker again. The Kutzker once said that if I wanted to, I can do Tchiyat HaMetim. I can bring the dead back to life. But he said, I'd rather bring the living back to life. That's what the Mishkan is. The Mishkan is there designed to bring the living people back to life. Because there's so many people that are walking, the walking dead. There's so many people walking around that have lost the spark, they've lost the spirit, they've lost the innocence. Spiritual zombies all over the place. A glimpse of the Kedusha, which we're not even ready to do. We can only do it by klisheni, right? We can only do it by klisheni, by looking into the eyes of the Kohen Gadol afterwards. That's as close as we can get right now. But that can take us back to where we were by Gan Eden before the sin. That's what the whole Mishkan is about. Beseder. We will continue.